Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Many observers of the nation's state courts have noted a number of disturbing trends in many states' judiciary, from state legislatures' unwillingness or inability to fully fund court operations to the emergence of political money in judiciary elections. As a result, courts are increasingly relying on fees and fines to fund operations. That, in concert with political money increasingly playing a role in elections and judicial retentions, has turned attention to the ethics governing those judges and courts and the integrity of the judicial system. My guest today will be speaking about what he calls the fade-out of American justice, the nation's state court crisis. My guest today is Lincoln Kaplan, the Truman Capote Visiting Lecturer in Law at Yale Law School. Kaplan has been a journalist, and he's a regular contributor to The New Yorker, but he's also written for The New York Times and the U.S. News & World Report. He was editor and president of Legal Affairs from 2000 to 2006. He's written a number of books, including Skadden, Power, Money, and the Rise of an Empire, and Up Against the Law, Affirmative Action in the Supreme Court. He'll be giving the 19th Annual John W. Hager Distinguished Lecture on Law tonight at 6 o'clock in John Rogers Hall on the University of Tulsa campus. That lecture is free and open to the public, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Lincoln Kaplan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
You're going to be speaking about what you refer to as the nation's state court crisis, and there have been a number of accounts, but it really isn't making the general news about what's happening in a lot of states' court systems. What would you say the number one issue is?
The number one issue is the lack of political clout of state courts. They, for a generation now, have insisted that they're a co-equal branch of government and they should be respected that way, and there should be a funding mechanism that supports them that way because of the services that they need to provide. And in one state after another, to the point where it's now across the United States, the court systems have been treated like the Department of Motor Vehicles, competing for budget with all the other agencies in a state, and really stripped of the respect and legitimacy that's essential for state courts to play in our democracy. This is the most important issue about the challenge to our democracy that people are not talking about.
Contrast that to the federal system. Isn't the federal judiciary in sort of the same boat? I mean, they're appropriated by Congress.
It is indeed, and each year they send one justice who is appointed by a Democrat and one justice who is appointed by a Republican, and they very politely present the budget. And you have a sense with those conversations between them and the members of Congress that they are restraining their anger to have to justify their budget and in a way beg for funds. The most galling thing for the federal judiciary for a long time was that they didn't get any raise. They didn't even get a cost of living raise, let alone the kind of raise that Congress gives itself. And in the end, six federal judges had to sue in order to address this issue. And that issue was held up on a split vote by a court of appeals. And the Supreme Court, thankfully, from the point of view of lower court judges, decided not to review that. And so there is now a regular cost of living increase again. But it's the same issue, and the problem is similar in the federal system and the state system, which is that the courts end up being politicized in the process for having to beg for funding. So at the state level, there are really interesting conversations going on among the chief justices who have their own conference about having a what they call a scientific or an objective measure, perhaps a workload per judge, which will justify their budget. And when it's necessary to have additional judges and additional court staff to support those judges, that there will be the funding to come along with that. But every year, the problem continues. It was very acute in 2008 and 2009. The Great Recession made this such a drastic problem for state courts that the American Bar Association, which has been a real advocate for adequate and really sustainable funding for courts for all kinds of reasons, got Ted Olson and David Boyce, better known for their partnership on behalf of gay marriage, to lead a commission that was about the preservation of justice. That's what the task force was called. They held town meetings all across the country to gather information, and in 2011, they put out a really important report called The Crisis in the Courts, which in 20 pages laid out all of the issues that flow from inadequate funding, and I'd be happy to talk about those.
Yeah, and you talk about 2008 and 2009 being the big issues for all states. It hasn't gotten any better in a lot of Republican-led states that have lowered state taxes, where you're continuing to see major budget shortfalls. The courts are feeling this just as much as other agencies. Is there an easy solution for separating the operation of the court out from the political process?
There would be, except for judicial elections. The fact that in 22 states, the justices or judges of the highest court are elected, and if you include retention states, that is, states where judges are appointed and then they have to win in a so-called nonpartisan election to retain their seats, that has politicized the state court justice system in a way that makes what otherwise, in theory, would be a non-political solution possible. And there are either great or heartbreaking examples all over the country that show how bad the state court elections have been for the courts themselves. There's some really interesting history about this. In the mid-19th century, states moved to election of judges as a way of getting around corruption. What was happening in many states is that the bosses of whatever industry, whether it's natural resources or some other, were controlling the executive branch, and in particular the governor, and they were getting their people appointed. And so there was a popular uprising, which led to state constitutional amendments in a bunch of states, with a sense that people were taking back the courts as an institution of democracy. And what's happened in the last 20 years, but really the last decade in particular, is that all of the democratic hope that was invested in this way of selecting judges has been undermined by politics.
Well, it's also undermined by the fact that most normal people who have to vote on the judges really know nothing about the candidates. In a lot of races, like district races, there's not a lot of money unless there's a particular issue involving an incumbent judge that gathers public attention.
And so, when it does get public attention, it's usually because of the political valence of the issue rather than the legal choice that a judge had to make in that particular case. And there are instances at trial court levels and at appellate levels where cases that have been politicized, where the law was quite clear about the constraints on what a court could do, nonetheless, people have been persuaded by politicians who wanted to control that particular court that the person was an ogre and needed to be thrown out. The Appeal is a John Grisham book, and it's exactly about this issue. And it's eerie because while he was writing a fiction that was meant to frame an issue, in court after court around the country, there have been incidents like that.
Well, the corollary is at the time that the actual court operations are being starved for money, you're seeing more money going into these judicial elections. Here in Oklahoma, I know we've had a couple of jurisdictions where there was a lot of money flowing in for the judgeship, and you saw signs all over town. You didn't really see ads because it's a different thing, but you saw a lot of money flowing into a district judgeship. In Iowa, after the marriage equality decision, you saw huge amounts of money flowing into the retention of a certain Supreme Court justices there, and I think several were defeated out of that.
And the post-Citizens United, which was the 2010 Supreme Court opinion where the U.S. Supreme Court addressed an issue that hadn't been presented to the court in order to overturn a couple of precedents and a century-old federal statute, there's unlimited funding of independent efforts that are supposedly around issues rather than candidates. And those have been absolutely effective in changing the outcome of elections. I've written for the past 3 years regularly about the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And I've done that because if you were choosing great state courts 20 years ago, 30 years ago, the Wisconsin court would always have been on the list. Wisconsin has this unusual combination of a progressive past, but at the same time, a kind of past of moderation in politics. It was as close to a truly bipartisan state as you could have. And the court reflected that independence of thinking, very high quality. And because of the importance of certain issues in the state, conservatives, outsiders, set up political action committees that have made those elections a food fight. And That court is now controlled by conservatives elected through this process, and it's especially worth looking at as a kind of case study because it's changed rules of the court beyond the political issues. So one of the most important questions for anyone in thinking about selection of a justice, however it happens, is will she be independent?
Impartial.
Will she keep an open mind when she's learning about a case and what law needs to apply to the facts before the court? And the perception of being impartial is as important as actually being impartial, because courts don't have, as it's been said, they don't have an army to enforce their rulings. They count on citizens to respect their deliberation and the results they reach and to honor them, even if it leads to a significant change in law. It used to be at the Wisconsin Supreme Court that if a lawyer gave a significant contribution to a justice in an election, that was grounds for recusal because it would avoid the perception of partiality. And what this court did with a logic that is all its own was to say, no, we're going to get rid of that recusal rule. So if there's a situation, and several have come up in Wisconsin, where an outsider would think, my gosh, he shouldn't be sitting on that case because that law firm has represented him in an ongoing litigation. But the justice decides he's going to sit, that he doesn't feel like he has a conflict. There's nothing that can be done by anybody about that, including other members of the court. And if you add the sense that the court's been politicized with the sense that the court no longer has the high ethical standards that the citizens expect of it, you've got a court that has lost standing and legitimacy very quickly in a way that's dramatic and shows the problem of election of judges.
Of course, this is another impact of money being in the case, because all of a sudden you do have contributors. And as the Supreme Court just ruled, a judge can't go out and ask for money. It just has to be given to him.
So if you now think about the tremendous attention that judicial elections have been drawing over the last decade and will, now that the outside money is looking at retention elections as an opportunity to change a court, retention elections used to be, is she doing a good job? And the bar paid close attention to this. And
if nobody else, really.
And the point got out that, yes, this justice has done a fine job. We're lucky to have her on the court. Or, gosh, maybe as her term's coming to a close, she might think about retiring. But it was handled based on substance and without political thunder. And now, because that's such a dramatic issue and easy to put on the nightly news, that's one of several issues which have eclipsed the state court funding issue and all of the things that flow from it.
The other side of the starving of money for the state court funds is how courts get money to operate. And that's a heavy reliance on fees and on fines. And you're seeing in states like Oklahoma and many other states, people are being jailed because they can't pay the fines. And those fines are crucial for the court's operation to just keep the doors open and keep court in session.
So I think there are three problems with that. The first is that justice is a public interest, and this is something that should be funded with no strings attached so that courts can fairly apply law to facts and do justice. And the fact that we've moved away from that system as a matter of budget gimmickry is itself a problem. The second problem is that it gives judges a conflict. A judge who is worried about the budget of his court or worried about being seen as a team player has an interest in making a decision that is going to lead to a fee for the court rather than putting that aside because that's irrelevant to the judge's job and saying, how should I treat this person before the court, whether it's a civil matter or a criminal matter? And the third reason is the most poignant and really the worst of the three, I think, which is that for people who are struggling economically, whether they're poor or living paycheck to paycheck or aren't certain that they're going to have a next paycheck, the idea that you're going to be treated perhaps unfairly by a court and then you're going to have to pay for it, and if you can't pay for it, you're going to go to the equivalent of an old debtor's prison, which state laws have generally outlawed, in order to be able to do something for the court. It's just an outrage. And fortunately, there are journalists in the states and at the national level who have realized what an outrage this is. And they're reporting it on the ground, showing case after case where, as a matter of unfairness, someone was put in jail because she couldn't pay a particular fee, and that fee mounted at exorbitant interest rates because she couldn't pay, and unfairness compounded unfairness.
My guest today is Lincoln Kaplan, the Truman Capote Visiting Lecturer in Law at Yale Law School. He's also a contributor to The New Yorker. He's written for other publications as well, but you can see him pretty regularly in The New Yorker. He's giving the 19th annual John W. Hager Distinguished Lecture on the fade-out of American justice, the nation's state court crisis. And that takes place tonight at 6 o'clock at the John Rogers Hall on the University of Tulsa campus, speaking on all sorts of aspects of state courts. You spend a lot of time writing, obviously, about the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court in particular. A case that has been of interest here in Oklahoma is the Richard Glossop case, which went up to the Supreme Court. His execution was stayed. And you say that if the future of the death penalty is in doubt, it's in large measure to Richard Glossop. So if it should happen, it'll be this case. What is special about this particular case?
The importance of this case is that it illustrates one of the worst problems with the administration of the death penalty, which is what the law calls reliability. This is a case where there was one man who pled guilty, confessed to committing a grisly murder, but claimed that he was put up to it by Richard Glossop. And while he changed his stories 8 different times by the count of Mr. Glossop's attorneys and has been consistently unreliable as a witness, though not challenged as fully as he should have by Mr. Glossop's attorneys, you've got a case where people who cover this issue, who represent death row inmates, and who have gotten exonerations in dozens of courts, believe that there's a very strong case, certainly raising reasonable doubt, about Mr. Glossop's guilt. And Stephen Breyer, who has been on the court for a long time and is a moderate for a long time, has been quiet about this issue. But he took the occasion of the 5-4 ruling by the Supreme Court last June, which addressed a challenge by Mr. Glossop and others to the lethal injection protocol that Oklahoma then used for executing death row inmates. While the court ruled 5-4 against Mr. Glossop, which is why there was a recent drama in the state about whether he would be executed or that would be stayed, Justice Breyer wrote a 41-page dissent in which he, in a way that reminded readers of his work as a scholar at Harvard Law School before he became a judge, went through all of the best scholarship, much of it empirical, over the last 20 years, raising profound questions about whether states can meet constitutional standards in applying the death penalty. Let me just say a little bit more about that. One of the most important and little-known institutions in the United States for lawyers and judges and scholars is called the American Law Institute. It's really above and beyond politics. That plays no role in what they do. They generally look at areas of law that they think are troubled enough or full of contradictions enough that a group of judges and lawyers and scholars should look at what reforms would make the law more sensible to apply. And they put out model statutes for states and model rules. And in 2009, they issued a report by a brother and sister team, Carol Steiker at Harvard Law School, Jordan Steiker at University of Texas Law School at Austin, which looked at the application of the death penalty since it was reinstated in the mid-70s by the Supreme Court. And what they found was that it was so unreliable. There was so much unfairness. There were so many individuals who were given the death penalty who had had just terrible representation by lawyers, lawyers who fell asleep during trials, lawyers who did no preparation. It's a really important report. And it convinced the American Law Institute that there was nothing that they could do to make this area of law work. And what had started to happen before and what's happened since then is that the Supreme Court has, as lawyers call it, constitutionalized this area of law. They've put limits on, they've set rules about process. And what Justice Breyer did was he revisited issues raised by that important ALI report, but he brought the scholarship current. And he was convinced that states so much more often are applying the death penalty in a way that, is not constitutional, that there's enough evidence that this is the time for the court to review this directly as a substantive matter and decide yes or no. And what's important about this is that Justice Scalia, in the week or so before the opening of term this week, gave a talk at Rhodes College in Tennessee where he said he wouldn't be surprised if the court overturned the death penalty, said that it's unconstitutional. In his view, there are four declared votes. I think some of the justices might disagree with that. And the fifth vote, of course, is most likely to be Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy has addressed the importance of dignity in a number of constitutional areas, including related to the death penalty. And while no one has said that that is a lock, that he would surely vote against it, he is concerned about these issues of fairness. And again, under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, has found areas of law that just needed to be changed wholesale out of respect for the dignity of individuals, in particular in the gay marriage area.
Now, this comes at a time when you just wrote a few months ago that for the first time in history, the court is regularly polarized along political lines, which makes the party of the president who appointed a justice the most salient fact about him or her. How does this change the court dynamics on a case like this or any case?
I think that the justices are very sensitive about this, and especially with the leadership of Chief Justice Roberts, who has a kind of split approach to the law, and part of him is influenced by Judge Henry Friendly, who he clerked for on the Second Circuit, who was a moderate by conviction, and part of him has the model of Chief Justice William Rehnquist, who he clerked for, and he and sometimes is a Friendly-like moderate and sometimes is a Rehnquist-like extreme conservative. But as much as possible, and the term before this one was full of examples, has sought common ground across the bench among the moderate liberals as well as the conservatives. Those are generally very, very narrow areas of agreement, very narrow opinions. But that reflects the sensitivity of all of the justices that they like very much to think that they're not on a political court and not involved with a political institution.
Well, when you're deciding a very contentious issue or a major change, a 5-4 decision says, well, this is just one guy, you know, makes the difference. It's not the full imprimatur of the court because it's speaking with a very much divided voice.
That's true, but what's really striking if you look at 5-4 decisions, well, some of them get revisited, and that's certainly what happened in Citizens United. There are an awful lot of 5-4 rulings that have changed the direction of the law, sometimes at the U.S. Supreme Court level, sometimes at the state court level. The Massachusetts ruling, which was the first one under a state constitution upholding gay marriage, was a split vote with one vote difference between the majority and the dissenters. But that was transformative for Massachusetts and for other states and eventually pointing the way for the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's a very important difference from, say, a 7-2 or a 9-0 opinion. But whether it's 5-4 or not, it can transform an area of the law in a way that gets relied on by the country so that the court, even with people who are dissenters, not liking the direction of the law, thinking that it's settled in the sense that the issue has been addressed and resolved, and to their chagrin, the law is on a path that they thought was wrong but is now working.
Has that perception of politicization on the Supreme Court, has that hurt the institution and its viability in the decisions it makes?
I think there are two things that are the best explainers of why the confidence of the American people in the Supreme Court has gone down gradually over the last 10 years. It's not dramatic, but it's an indication that a court that is seen as a political body, that is seen as splitting along political lines on social issues, is respected less, is trusted less. One of the issues is this political division on the court. There's a bunch of very interesting scholarship where legal analysis borrows from political science done by Lee Epstein and two colleagues, Lee Epstein at USC in California, which says that if you look at the voting patterns of all justices since the Second World War, that this is the most conservative court in three quarters of a century and very conservative. But they've also made the interesting observation that when the Chief Justice is not going to be the dispositive vote, he's not going to decide a 5-4 ruling when he'll be the sixth vote or the seventh vote, he's much more moderate. But that the politicization of the court in the sense of just reaching results that are perceived by political scientists to be more conservative is a significant factor. The second one is that the Supreme Court is anomalous in a surprising way that didn't get a lot of attention until about 5 years ago. And that is that it's the only federal court, and really the only court in the country, that is not bound by a judicial code of ethics. So there's a federal judicial code of ethics that binds every court of appeals judge, every federal district judge, every magistrate judge working with federal district judges. But the Supreme Court was not bound by that because there was a sense that it would be inappropriate to have lower courts or the Senate imposing on this co-equal branch at the highest level this kind of constraint.
Lower courts were created by Congress. The Supreme Court was created by the Constitution.
Absolutely. And yeah. So this has been such an important issue and really a controversial issue that several years ago, the Chief Justice used his end-of-the-year report on the state of the judiciary to address this question. And he's a beautiful writer. He's a really skillful advocate. It was an impressive piece of work. And the basic argument was there are statutes that require us to recuse ourselves in certain instances. We observe those. And we don't need to be bound by the federal judicial code because we refer to it when an issue comes up. And in any case, we're the Supreme Court, and we need to make our own rules. And that was a decision that conservative scholars support and advocate others to respect. And it drew a lot of criticism from the people who study this issue most seriously and who have the respect for really being the guides about how these issues should play out. A very small group of ethicists about judicial standards. And so it's a stalemate. No one's going to impose that on them. A congressman and a senator have each written a bill proposing that the judicial code be applied to them. And the court keeps saying, you know, please don't. And so far, it hasn't happened.
Sounds like ethics will be a more important part of the judicial process, both at the federal level and the state level as we move ahead.
Well, at the state level, without question, it just has to happen because the problems are bursting left and right. And at the federal level, it'll be a quieter issue, but for people in the Supreme Court culture, a very important one.
Lincoln Kaplan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Lincoln Kaplan is the Truman Capote Visiting Lecturer in Law at Yale Law School and a regular contributor to The New Yorker magazine. He'll be giving the 19th annual John W. Hager Distinguished Lecture on Law, titled The Fade Out of American Justice, The Nation's State Court Crisis. The lecture takes place tonight at 6 o'clock in the John Rogers Hall on the University of Tulsa campus and is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.